In today's topic, dealing with procurement. You know, what do you get up to? What options do you have? You know, what's worked for you in the past and what might not have worked for you in the past? And given that we're a nice, relatively small group tonight, I'm going to propose we just sort of go in a round, if you like, and perhaps start sharing some of our stories, what has worked for you, what might not have worked, and any other tips or ideas you have. And if I come to you during the round and you don't have anything to say, and that's fine too. You can just let us know and we'll move on to the next person. You know, you might have something to say later on, or maybe you're just here to listen. But I thought we'd just head around the traps. And perhaps if, Jim, if you're cool to sort of kick us off, I deliberately asked Jim to join us this evening. I mean, not only is he the host of the End-to-End Singapore community, but he's also got some experience working with procurement people. And he also comes from a negotiation background. So I just thought, hang on, there's something useful there. and he also knows some other people in the industry who work quite a lot with procurement. So it might be an interesting place to start. So Jim, if you're okay with that, why don't we kick off with you, mate?
Okay, all right. Well, I guess as a training provider to procurement, I've had quite a range of experiences. In some cases, it's, as you're saying in your email, where you're talking to the business unit or you're talking to HR, and then they say, okay, that's great, now work out an agreement with procurement. So if that's the first contact with procurement, that's quite often a difficult one. There are other cases where it turns the other way around. So you might know procurement quite well, and they introduce you to the business units when they have a problem, and variations of both of those. So in the first case, it's always a bit tricky. If you don't know procurement and then you're passed over or handed over to procurement to finalise a contract or something, it's the problem with that is you're kind of restarting. And if they've got some other agenda, you know, they're trying to cut costs, or, you know, they've got some KPIs that they want to fulfill, then they can actually be quite difficult. So I guess the trick there is, as much as possible, to engage early with procurement if you think that you're going to have to deal with them at some point, which then goes to the second point, where procurement's leading the charge, introduce you to the business unit. In that case, they'll often, you know, help coach you who you need to talk to get the business to buy in, or for you to win the business, because often they introduce two or three competitors together.
How often are you led in by the procurement people? I've only ever gone the other way. Like, I've always known the line manager or the HR buyer and then gone to procurement. I've never gone the other way around, from procurement back.
It happens from time to time. So if you pick if you've got some accounts that you really want to build a strong relationship with, it's always good to make a point of talking to procurement as well. In my case, because of the negotiation, often they're a target as well as procurement. So we might talk to procurement in the context of them wanting to get negotiation training, and we also talk to them in the context of how does your organisation work. And, you know, what's the best way to build a negotiation capability within the client? So, and between those two conversations, you can actually build up quite a good relationship with procurement, and then it works quite well.
And when you talk about procurement, Jim, do you include legal in that? Or is that another diversion that you sometimes need to go through on a contract?
In my experience, most of the time, legal will be behind procurement. It's unusual to have to deal with legal directly in a training situation. So for our kind of contracts, generally procurement's happy with that. And if they have any questions, they'll go back to their own internal legal people. On the negotiation side, when we're working with clients on large negotiations, they will often have legal as part of the team, their negotiation team, because they know if they leave it to the end, then the lawyers will not be able to add much value other than to say, no, you shouldn't do that. But if you engage legal early in the negotiation, then they could often make suggestions as part of the negotiation process. But that typically only happens for very large negotiations where it's, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars.
So I guess one of the most common things that procurement asks for is a discount, right? And that's what most of us would experience along the way. What advice or what have you done in the past to help negotiate those sorts of circumstances?
The same tactics that you would use with a HR or a business unit can be used with procurement. So for example, if you provide a package and they want to negotiate down the package price, it's not always just about discounts. Ultimately, procurement are actually looking to create value for the company. So if you can then turn it around and say, well, you know, we knew price was important, so we've already given you the best price, but what we can do is to help you increase the value by adding some sort of bells and whistles or stretching it a bit more than the package, you know, still within the same framework, but we might do a bit of extra coaching or a bit of extra, an extra webinar to follow up or something like that. So by having procurement demonstrate that they created value, that's usually enough in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to hear from, you know, all of us tonight, I guess, how do we demonstrate value? Yeah, and make that buying decision a lot easier for procurement. We may well come back to you, Jim. I just might keep the rounds moving, and then because then we'll get a flavour from everyone, and we can kind of go around again. And Sarah, you're next along my little grid of people. do you deal with procurement much? Is there something, a story or a way that you guys add value you might be able to share?
To be honest with you, in Malaysia, so we are a training company as well, People Potential. And in Malaysia, I can only speak for Malaysia because I don't deal with the clients in Singapore and outside Malaysia. That's in my colleagues deal with that. So for Malaysia, we usually deal with HR like 90% of the time. We just deal with HR. And for us, procurement is just it's just a formality to get the purchase order, you know, get the paperwork. Sometimes the training is agreed and it's done. And then when it comes to getting the payment is when the procurement gets involved, which is obviously not right in terms of the order of paperwork. But, you know, we've never had any problems with procurement. My guess is HR deals with procurement internally and, you know, it just gets approved internally. And so we don't deal with that. Don't go through the negotiations like Jim does.
So they're more of an administrative layer than anything else.
Yeah. So I thought Jim's experience is quite interesting because, in the 2 years I've been doing this, I might come across something in the future, but in the 2 years, I haven't come across having to deal with procurement.
Oh, you lucky girl.
I don't know, maybe it's just the way business is done here. But regarding your other question, which is how to demonstrate value, we do get asked this question by HR or business unit. And we just say, you know, look at the repeat clients we have. So 90% of our clients have repeated with us. We're not the cheapest training, but you get really good value for money. And that's demonstrated by the amount of repeats we get every year.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. Ken, do you have any stories from your recent or long past, I suppose?
There's a few things we can come back to later, but we have had one experience with legal recently. Pete can tell me whether we can talk about the company or not, but with a very large and well-known company who insisted on using their standard supplier contract which included a clause that anything we gave them was their intellectual property, including our intellectual property, which was, as you know, in our business, is part of the package. I've had that before, but 20 years ago, and that was with another company in the same industry, the high-tech industry, where I guess they're getting contract work done in coding and other areas and design. They want to have exclusive rights to it. But it doesn't work for us. Unfortunately, the most recent one, you worked on for 2.5 years?
About 2 years. It's still going, yeah.
But the whole thing has just become a...
Stalemate,
yeah. With our lawyer saying that, well, if you want that, the quote for the workshop is $20+ million or something, because you get the whole package or whatever number he makes up.
The lawyer was saying to the client, well, look, if you want that clause to remain, then you're basically buying our company. So the quote will change to $20 million instead of, you know, $20,000. So that was his cheeky response to the client, which is kind of fun. You know, it points out the absurdity of the clause that's in there. But look, I mean, legal aside, what about dealing with, you know, procurement that wants a discount, Ken? What have you done in the past?
I've done better negotiating with. I've dealt with that with people where the budget moved from 1 year to the next, but our costs had gone up, and so the price had changed, or the event had moved, and I simply negotiated creatively with the HR people and said, well, first of all, with half a smile on my face, which bit do you want me to leave out? But that actually opened up a discussion. And we said, why don't we tailor it for this group? And we went down a track that meant we finished on the second day at afternoon tea, and I caught a plane home from Hong Kong to Singapore 3 hours earlier than I otherwise would, and got in my own bed that night. I was very happy to give away a few bucks, but the face was saved by that little maneuver, both ways, and I saved money. So that my first instinct is to ask about what's behind the issue. The other thing that comes to mind is a group of affiliates that we were with in a country recently, and they kind of said, well, we'll all add 10%, and when we get to the hand of procurement, we're ready to knock it off. You know, that'll keep everybody happy. So that covers a range of possibilities.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when I sort of proposed this conversation, I heard from Hal, who's now living in the UK, and he wrote and said, apologies, he couldn't make it to this chat, but he said he recently had an experience with procurement, and one of the options in his own mind for next time round was to just bump the price up in the initial quote so that he could give them a discount at the procurement level when it got to procurement. That's a common response. It's what happened in India, as Ken was referring to. My own experience, for whatever reasons, I've sort of grown up in this business with the mantra that we don't give discounts. And I've worked from that foundation. So in some ways it makes you or forces you to demonstrate value. But it also, and as I said to Jim earlier, I've only ever really gone to procurement after a decision maker in the organization has said that we really want this program. Okay, now can you please deal with procurement? And when procurement comes to me in that circumstance and says, well, look, you know, what can you do? What discounts can you give me? I just say, I'm sorry, that's the price. You know, it doesn't change. And I think perhaps that just comes from the knowledge that I know they want the program. The decision makers actually want it. So, you know, I'm not in a position of needing to discount. On the very odd occasion, I know a big industrial company that we've worked with globally about 18 months ago. They asked for discounts for doing it in multiple locations around the world. And again, I said to them, look, I'm sorry, we don't discount. One of the main reasons for that is that I treat every client fairly. You know, I treat you the same as I've treated the people that I worked with last, and I'm going to treat you the same as I'm going to work with the next people that, that we go to. And that's our philosophy and the best way to work with you all very, very fairly. And that, look, I recognize, and you know, in this circumstance, you know, you've booked, I don't know, 15 workshops across 10 different countries, and that's fabulous. We don't discount, but look, what I will do is perhaps add something of value. And I asked in that circumstance, hey, perhaps we could run a one-day workshop. We'll do it free of charge, but if you offer it and you give me an audience that's a different audience within your organization. So basically, I was asking for something of value from them, and in return, I would give them something of value and give a free workshop. But by asking for a different audience within the company, I was hoping to perhaps even grow our business further. You know? So it was kind of a, you know, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine, in a way. And that went down pretty well. I'm just going to flick to an email that...
Peter, sorry, may I ask?
Yeah, go Sarah.
So you said it went down quite well with procurement. So did it, you know... did something happen further down the line, you know, with the different audience? Did it work in the long run?
In the end, they didn't book it. Yeah, they didn't even go there.
Oh,
but
right.
It got me past that hurdle, if you like,
of
them wanting something, you know, because procurement have to often answer to someone, see? And they want to be able to go to their boss, manager, whatever, and say, well, look what I got.
Something that we do is we don't give discount on our trainers' fees, but we give discount on the materials. So that seems sometimes, you know, some clients, they're quite insistent on getting discounts on with the professional fees, but after a while, they seem to be content with just the materials fees.
Yeah.
Which raises an interesting question, which we don't have to have, but the question you're asking, should we unbundle or keep the bundle together? And I won't attempt to answer it, but that's and does it give more, transfer more power to the buying negotiator to try and pick the bit apart? I personally always, for our product, I put in a bundle and maybe a bit more for some extra clients, but I don't quote two prices. And people have different views about this, but I just want to point out that's some other area to think in. What works work best for you?
Sarah, do you know what he means by the bundle?
Yeah. Sorry, there's a thunderstorm here, so you might be able to hear it.
I can hear it.
The bundle meaning it's just one price, so that's inclusive of the trade, the training fees, materials.
But it may be for, say, 10 people or 12 people or 15 people, you can change the price of the bundle. But if they say, look, we're aiming for 15 people workshop, we might only get 12. So, okay, I'll give you a price of 12 and here's the incremental price for additional people. So either way, it's kind of like a bundle, but you haven't separated out the trainer fee and the intellectual property fees. That make any sense? Because it probably gives them two targets to move at, you know. Or either your materials are much more expensive than anybody else's, or your trainers are much more expensive, or both, of course, right?
I definitely agree that our professional fees are higher than the industry average. So in terms of the negotiation, I do find that if we really stick to our guns and say we can only give you discount on the materials fee, they eventually go for it. And what seems to please them is we say that we charge the number of participants in the room itself. So the professional fees, the trainer fees, don't actually get affected at all, you know, regardless whether 8 people turn up, 12 or 16. So we guarantee that bit, but the materials is flexible.
I'll move on to you in a second, Cosmin, but look, in the effort of kind of doing rounds, there was another end-to-end member, Shark, who's in Amsterdam, and he wrote and said he's sorry he couldn't make it today, but he shared something with me via email. I thought I'd share it with you. So he says that in the few cases that he's had to deal with the purchasing department, he pre-negotiated the full deal with the highest possible authority in the client department first. So if the purchasing department starts, you know, negotiations with him, he refers them back to the line manager. And when that's not possible, he says he was very transparent up front via the line managers or wherever he was originally working, what his zone of possible agreement was and what his walkaway point was. So he sort of set that very early on before he got to procurement or purchasing, if you like. And he says here, and I think this is an interesting part, that the key strategy was to make the negotiations with the purchasing department the problem of the line manager instead, and not his problem. So he gets in very early to work out that strategy up front with the line manager.
It's not bad advice.
Yeah, it's nice. Kind of flip the negotiation to be internal there, not on his back. So he says, yeah, when entering into that sort of prospecting situation, he tries to find out as soon as possible who are the key decision makers. But he also says he's forgotten to do that sometimes. So. The last thing he shares is on the rare occasion that he's had to deal with purchasing and to negotiate with them, he tried to find out what their reference point was. And I guess... Can you kind of explain this earlier on? What do you mean?
Well, I guess if the reference point meant another program, let's take our case with Thing on Your Feet. If somebody says, well, look, you can get a presentation skills program for this price. Oh, okay, so the reference point is now presentation skills. You're way ahead of me now, so you can understand. So now I know if I can demonstrate that we offer more or something different or something more valuable or something more special or something more relevant, then there's more value involved, right? So I can say, yes, Thing on Your Feet does help people in presentations in this way, but it also would do these things and this thing and this thing and this thing, right? It
gives you that reference point on which to demonstrate your value again. So we're back to that same phrase, aren't we? Yeah. Okay, cool. We've probably spoken enough for the moment. Time to sort of keep going on the round. Cosmin, if you're still there and you've got your microphone.
I'm still here.
Do you have any stories, experiences, tips?
So we recently won a project because of the purchasing department. Because the client, well, it was a tender for a training of ours, which... requested a certified program, and the winner was appointed by the lowest price. We had our partner in that country, which knew all the competitors and knew all the programs, and he pointed out to the purchasing department that the winning competitor didn't have the certification process. So we went back to the client and pointed them out that, okay, the winner cannot offer certification and he should reconsider the entire tender. And in the negotiation, we did not reduce the price. We added an additional facilitator, which is actually the partner in that country.
Okay. Oh, so you added more value. Same price.
Added more value, yes. At the same price by adding a second facilitator. So in the first proposal, we had only one subject matter expert on balance scorecard. And just not to reduce the price, we added someone else, which is a local with experience and in oil and gas, which is the industry of the client.
Thank you. Cosmin, thank you. Chris, I just want to check back in with you. Make sure
ironically, this is great stuff, and thank you so much for your initiative to put this together. It's awesome to do this, and a great demonstration of the spirit and the practicality of end-to-end. I personally have had more experience on the other side. I've been on the buying side many times because I spent so many years in Allianz on the
right.
Corporate.
Sure.
For us, we would start with an RFI RFP process. So the business side will say what they want, then we'll go out and do a you know, a dragnet of how many. And so I could hear what Jim I think was saying about the procurement department can introduce the business side too, and that can actually come through an RFI RFP process, because you'll identify suppliers who the business may have never heard of. So that also happened. And in one deal that I ran, that actually that guy won, was somebody that we had identified the business had never heard. And that's very useful to do that. One thing that we've been doing recently, we've been winning some contracts in Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, where the budgets are not nearly at Western levels, let's say, typically. So what we, on some semi-creative way, we've been getting around their local prices, and also this reference, because when they compare our prices using that reference model idea to what a local Czech or Romanian or whatever Polish guy, we look very expensive. So we have been had some success with pulling in the regional headquarters, even the global headquarters, to sort of chip in to the deal, to find some budget elsewhere, because those guys aren't scared off by our prices, because they're also in the West. They're in Munich or in London. So that's a way that we won a couple of deals that way, where we would have been uncompetitive because our prices were three times what a local, say, Prague-based trainer can do. Another thing that I ran was we'd call it a best fit matrix. I mean, you said, Peter, that you know, price is always the decider, but it's not always the decider, because there's a number of criteria, of course, and each one has a weighting. You know, so price may be 60% or 30% or, you know, but reputation is very important. Scope of what's being offered, the quality of the team that's being offered. So all those things. So that's where the weight can come. If we can't compete on price because we're sort of a premier provider, we have to push extra hard on the other points.
I absolutely agree with you, and I didn't mean to. I'm sorry if I infer that price was the only decision maker. I just meant that they often come back to you for a discount. You
know? No, they often do, and I love the creativity of people here to come back with okay, we won't discount. I like your principle of we don't give discounts as a point of principle, but we will, you know, do things to demonstrate that we add value, such as this best fit thing that, you know, we've got the top reputation. Somebody said the idea about repeat business, that we demonstrate value by showing that, look, 90% of our clients are repeat business. That demonstrates by itself. I mean, that's the gold standard of adding value.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. Maybe I'll have more later, but...
That's cool. But I'm going to do my best and quickly share something that Stephen Kozicki, some of you might know Stephen, he's an Aussie here. He's also in negotiation. He's probably negotiated some pretty large deals in his time. But he shared with me, it was a PDF of a summary of a presentation that was given by a big client, if you like, and how their world has changed and turned into dealing with procurement a lot. And the key part of what it reminds you is that there are different types of procurement people, or different types of procurement buyers, right? And I guess not to forget that. Now, of course, even within the individuals that you deal with, they might be different. So if you think of that from a social style, right, just stop and think about, you know, kind of person you're dealing with as an individual, that might help you in the procurement discussion. But there's also, I'll just share this screen with you. I don't want to get too elaborate. I think it's helpful. Those of you who can see the screen, if they're not calling in on a telephone, but, and there's that little matrix there about, you know, there's the four different types of procurement, the academics, the administrators, the professionals, and the consolidators. And each are different in terms of their influence, power, etc., within the organization.
And there's maturity on one axis and influence on the other.
Yeah, I suppose for those who aren't with us tonight in the conversation or listen to the recording, it's a bit hard to see that. But those with the greatest procurement influence and the greatest maturity are the professionals. You know, they're the smart and powerful value managers. And those ones you need to build strong relationships with, for sure. The lowest in the terms of influence and maturity are the administrators, and they're labelled here as transactional, powerless procurement. So they're sort of just an admin gateway, a bit like Sarah was sharing very early on in the call. I'm just going to flip the screen here, and they go a little bit more into, you know, how to engage those different buyer types. And for those who are with us on screen, they can see that. I'm not going to go into all the different levels here because this is, you know, that could take a long time. What I wanted to do by sharing that was just to remind ourselves that, hey, you know, you're going to run into different types of procurement, you know, wherever you go, and to stop and check and make sure you ensure that you are meeting the, I guess, the value representation for that particular procurement, you know, group and or individual. So make sure you tailor it for that individual. And that was, yeah, that was Stephen Kosicki's contribution. And Stephen has also put his hand up to, if anyone wants to talk more about that or learn more or hear what he's got to say about it, he's happy to talk to anyone. Ken, you've been listening a lot. Any other thoughts what we should do to...
Well, that last point is interesting in that matrix. Not all procurement officers or managers or executives or vice presidents are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so we're also talking about people and positions and power here of varying degrees in each case. And so if we have one standard approach, we're going to need to check in our data bank, it's going to work for all of them, we'll modify it appropriately.
Yeah. And if procurement's your gateway, a bit like Jim was sharing on, early on as one of the options, and Chris was also saying, then I guess the key is to build the same sorts of relationships with them as you would with a line manager. Was that accurate, Chris? Is that what we should be doing?
Yeah, I'm back. And by the way, it looks like Clive is back on, so maybe he has something to add. Yes, certainly. That's very smart politicking. But it's only... makes sense, like I think Ken said, if you know it's, or maybe it was Jim, it's a company that you know is somebody who you really want to invest in, because that takes significant time, and they're also a bit allergic to it. I mean, it has to be done very, bribery and whatnot is that can easily go quite wrong so it has to be done very subtly and probably over.
Still, that's a very interesting thought. What is really being thrown out here, one way of framing it is, should you do prospecting calls on the purchasing department? Well, it's still so stupid, actually.
It is a very, very smart idea. If you're willing, if you know, like I think Jim said, that this is a company that I want to invest in, that I want to make a long, because it's a significant investment of time and effort. Yeah. They're not going to be buying anything from you that day. That's something that may turn out after a year or two or more even.
But it is a really good conversation to get going. And one thing that we didn't mention before is the idea of a preferred supplier agreement. So with purchasing people, they'll often have a once-off service agreement just for a workshop or a group of workshops. But the holy grail is actually to get a preferred supplier agreement with the purchasing department, so you don't have to go through purchasing every time. They have an agreement that lasts for 3 years or 5 years, and they just say, oh, we need Think on Your Feet Again, come in, or we need presentation skills, come in. And everything's already, the pricing and the terms and everything already prearranged. And that is a really nice place to be.
Do you have any suggestions to how one gains that status? I like it.
It takes a lot of conversations to get there, but it's more procurement focused than business focused. So it's good to work with both, to talk to procurement about what does it take to be on their preferred list, and then with the business to help the business to also provide good noises to procurement to say, yes, you should consider these people for that list. And often you'll find that the business and procurement work together to basically develop a short list of their preferred suppliers.
Thanks.
And do you find that more so in semi-government or government than in private, or is it the same, like this preferred list of suppliers thing? I've heard of it in government quite a bit.
No, we had that in Allianz as well. We definitely had a preferred in specific sectors like IT. Yeah. Maybe not for like strategy, but in certain sectors, there's definitely a preferred supplier network.
Okay.
Cool.
It also makes your invoicing process go much smoother because they've got the whole your whole invoicing directly in. You don't have all those horrible months and months of delays when you're in that in your in that network.
Speaking of which, is payment terms is that frequently negotiated, or do you discover that later when you haven't been paid after 5 months? No, but there is an international company in Singapore that everybody has found out now is a minimum 4 months to get paid, but when they went into it, they didn't know. But also love to know what
Jim's just got to finish up what he said.
Sorry, I beg your pardon.
No, I've pretty much finished that. It was about the preferred supplier agreement, but on the point of payment terms, generally it should be known up front as part of that agreement process. Although from time to time, companies do change and they say, oh, it used to be 45 days and now everyone has to be 60 days, which is always a bit of a mystery to me. You know, why piss off your best suppliers? But they seem to like doing that. Mm-hmm. I think that's more of finance than procurement. Procurement are executing what they've been told by finance. But that kind of thing is always a mystery to me. But in my experience, most of the time it's up front. But the biggest gotchas are if you don't get the paperwork right, then you can lose weeks and months because something didn't get processed or you don't realise something wasn't processed. So one of the advantages of, well, it's not just preferred suppliers, but especially preferred suppliers, is often there's e-invoicing. Yeah. And if you're a preferred supplier, then you basically log on to your portal and, you know, send all the invoices through and you can be guaranteed that they're captured and often you can see if they've been approved or not.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. I'm wary. Clive, you've popped back onto our radar here. We were talking earlier about demonstrating value and tips and ideas, stories working with procurement. What can you share with us?
Yeah, apologies, I missed a bit of that. Our internet dropped out here. But for those of you who don't know me, I'm Clive Lewis. I've got a training company in the UK. I've been around a while. A couple of thoughts, I suppose. One, I'm not the world's biggest fan of procurement, if I'm really honest. I've been well and truly hammered by them a couple of times, and the rest of the times I try and avoid them. The vast majority of the work that we do, we tend to work directly with HR and training personnel, so the HR and training managers or the line managers, and wherever possible, I try and find out probably through experience, try and find out if procurement are going to be involved in the process at all, because part of the process of selling effectively, I guess, needs to be to identify all the decision makers, influencers in the process. And if you're going to go through a process that says, okay, let's get the technical requirements right, let's make sure that the course meets the requirements of the business, whether that's been determined by the line managers or the HR and training people, if that's part of the process, and then they're going to hand the whole thing over to procurement to smash the details, then I want to know that as soon as possible, because it's going to have an impact on my strategy for how I'm going to close the sale and build a long-term relationship. But I guess and I've got a couple of war stories on that I'm happy to share, but I guess the I'd probably be less positive than I think Chris, you were, and Jim, around when the process starts with procurement, because my experience is organisations, and it's the vast majority of the organisations who will start with an RFP or RFI sent out by the procurement team are going to be more price-led than not. So my experience on that is that most times when that's the start point, you're looking at a 30 or 40% weighting on cost. And unless you've got a very, very clear differentiator on one of the other criteria that's going to really smash it on and take the competition out, then you're going to really, we're certainly going to struggle if the thing's going to be that heavily cost led. And the other bit that goes with that is it's very easy and depressingly easy, I guess, for procurement then to send that RFP out to 10, 15, 20 different organizations. So again, you're in a situation where it can be just completely nonsensical to take part in a process that's going to be paper led rather than relationship led. I think that's the problem for me, is that if and whenever possible, which I think is everyone else has said to some extent as well, is that the whole thing needs to be relationship led, and if that's sometimes difficult to achieve with some of the box ticking that goes on through a procurement process and through a procurement department.
Thanks, mate. Good to hear some of your war stories sometimes, but also wary of the time. And I don't know if I advertised this as a 45-minute chat. I thought we might get through it a little sooner. I mean, I'm happy to keep talking. In the last, you know, let's try and wrap it up on the hour. Is anyone else, having heard all that, does anyone else have anything they want to throw into the hat, speak out loud, or throw it in the chat box?
I've got a couple of things. Procurement is changing. Procurement themselves are not static. And for many years, they've been often going for the lowest price and, you know, sending out RFIs and things in order to do that. But more and more, they're being called upon by the business to create value and to be a business partner. So the dialogue within procurement is also starting to change. At least at some levels. That's a positive change. Unfortunately, there's also a negative change, and a lot of procurement is also getting outsourced as well to remote areas, which makes it harder to have that relationship. So more and more you're seeing procurement back offices in places like the Philippines. And when you've got somebody in the Philippines or in Bangalore, it's very hard to have any kind of relationship with them.
Yeah, I've dealt with procurement in India for a client that I got to know in Singapore. Yeah.
So they were the two things. So there's a positive move, but there's also a downside as well.
Good comment. Thank you. And I know that procurement via good people like yourselves, Jim, are also, they're learning how to negotiate, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. And it's not just about the technical side and the contracts and things. It's about the process skills for negotiation. Mm. Absolutely.
So they're getting more savvy in many ways. Okay, thanks, Jim. Anyone else?
Yeah, on that, Peter, I mean, I guess, yeah, that's true that there are some people in procurement who are strong negotiators, but I think it's a bit, sometimes it's easy to give them too much power because if you separate out the whole process of agreeing the spec and what you're going to deliver, and do all of that first up front with HR or training department or the line managers, and then allow yourself to be pushed into almost a completely separate conversation about terms and conditions and pricing. So you're separating the whole thing out. You've lost all your bargaining power. So really, you got to be. I think very, very mindful of where the different parts of the equation are going to fit together, and organisations that that enable you to, or force you down that route where you've ticked all the boxes, you've agreed that this is what you're going to deliver, this is when you're going to deliver, this is how you're going to deliver it, this is who's going to deliver it. And then they say, oh, and by the way, just need to go and have a conversation with our guys now about the pricing. Well, yeah, that's you can't have it. You can't allow yourself, I don't think, to be pushed into that situation, because you've lost all your bargaining chips right up front. So yeah, that's why I sort of talk about having view on who's involved from the client side. For each part of the overall business deal.
And how early will you ask that question, by the way?
Very early. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the qualification process, if you like, is who makes the decisions and who's involved in the decisions. So where there's, at that point, any suggestion that there's going to be other people than the people I'm dealing with initially, say the training manager or the HR manager, then I'll try and find that out as early as possible.
And do you ask to actually then meet with those people in procurement? Do you ask for the opportunity to, or do you back off and say, I don't want to deal with them?
Well, sometimes there's a couple of firms I definitely won't deal with again, that's for sure, because I know what their procurement people are like. And so yeah, there's a couple of people I'd back away from if they said procurement are going to be involved. But actually, looking at it more positively, I mean, the other aspect that Jim was talking about there in terms of preferred supplier agreements is if you can get through that process and get onto lists, that can mean something either very, very positive, or it can just be a tick that gets you in the game next time around. So there can be advantages, of course, of being involved. But yeah, if we know that they're going to be involved, then I want to know exactly what their involvement is, and are there some people that we need to be talking to earlier rather than later?
I like too that I guess I heard in a reminder that we've got a choice. You know, if you don't want to go down that line of having to deal with procurement, you can just move on to the next possible opportunity. You know, yep. Maybe that's the way you want to work, and that's cool too, right? You have choices about whether you discount or whether you don't. You know, in our case, we choose not to, and that's the way we approach everything. And we work from that foundation, and we try and find a way around that. And if ultimately they don't want the business, then they don't want the business. You know? So it is. I think it's important to have those, to know you have a choice, and to know where you want to go with your business and your value. And we started around demonstrating value and talking about how to demonstrate that. And we're all trying to do that every day, just with the line managers or HR and training. So we ought to be getting good or better at that every day. But, you know, it's good to be talking about this anyway. And as Jim rightly mentioned, you know, procurement is growing, and I've seen it over the last few years. It's growing in its role, or you know, how far its fingers are sort of reaching into our businesses and our lives. It's starting to grow, and some of them aren't just the administrative procurement. Some of them are those strategic ones, and we have to adapt and be ready for those.
So, it's kind of fun when you come across the ones without any power. I think they have got power.
Yeah, I like that too. You know, yeah. And I've done that, and that's happened. You know, like we talked about, some procurement moving to the Philippines or India. You know, the one in India that I dealt with, it was very easy to get through. I just said, sorry, no, we don't discount. You know, because I knew the line managers wanted it, and he had no power over. But
exactly, it's even more fun to say, are you sure you got the authority to ask that question? Can you go back to your to the line manager board?
I haven't written that down on my list of things to do.
trust me, because you're a lot of pleasure.
All right. Well, look, on that positive note and that little laugh, I think I'm going to wrap it up there. Thank you all very much for being a part of today's discussion.